are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on tonight's program, Dave interviews Ingrid Anderson about her new book of poetry, Yordamoder, Poems of a Midwife. Anderson has practiced as a home birth nurse midwife for over 20 years. In addition to her poetry, she is a healthcare activist and founder of related nonprofits. And she lives in Wisconsin, but that's okay.
And I'm Dave, who will be interviewing Ingrid soon. In the last part of the hour, Otto Kotz will have a discussion with We Are Married, a theater company run by Jay Eisenberg and Shelby Richardson, about their upcoming show, Big Game. Big Game is a live fever dream of a televised survivalist game show where one intrepid adventurer turned amateur filmmaker faces off with the elements. Will a lifetime of preparation be enough? And with a life-changing sum of money on the line, will they come out on top or get topped by nature itself? All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. Welcome, Ingrid.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thrilled to have you here. And how did my colleague Josh do on the pronunciation of your book?
I'm glad you brought that up. I was very impressed.
Yordamoder, that's what I would say. So welcome to the program. Ingrid, congratulations on the book. Out from Holy Cow Press.
Thanks.
Up in Duluth, one of our favorites.
We love them.
So Ingrid, before we start talking about your poems, and here's some of your poems, tell us how you came to poetry, if you would. I'm always curious about poets' relationship with poetry. Did they love poems early? Did they come to them at a certain point in their lives for a certain reason? Why are you a poet?
I think I've always been a poet. For me, everything is poetry, and Yordamoder is a terrific word for what I do, both as a poet and as a midwife. Both are practices that I feel have been in me my whole life, and you'll hear in the subject of the poetry why that may be true. And I began actually writing poetry when I was very young, but that to me is more of a breathing and a seeing and a listening and a way of being in the world. There's a great essayist from the New York Times, Eliza Gabbertz, I think is her name, who says poetry is liquid and the poem is the vessel. I came to poems late, but I feel I've always been swimming in that current of poetry. Midwifery is very conducive to that, of course. And so as I got older, and also was making a living, had a good day job, I turned to writing poems and really got started on a sabbatical that I took.
Midwifery seems like it is made for poetry. It's like a living mm-hmm. metaphor, right? And we're going to get a taste of that. But before we do, I'd like to have a reading to get things started. But before we do, do you want to tell us a little bit about, so we all know what we're talking about when we say, and it's midwifery as opposed to wifery? Go ahead.
Yeah, both are correct. I'm trying to bring Yordamoder into the English language because I just think it's the best word ever. Midwife means with woman. So, it's a model of care that has always been centering the pregnant person, and that person's health and well-being and whole experience. So Yordamoder goes even beyond that, in that Yord means earth in Swedish. Moder is mother, of course, and mm-hmm. Jord is a word that can mean also dirt and soil and land. So it's the planet all the way down to the dirt and what's in it, and that has a significance for midwives. It's an ancient word, And dirt is actually something that even clients of mine to this day who don't have access to prenatal vitamins, for example, they know what dirt's good. They literally eat dirt. We have a word for it. It's called pica. But this has been done everywhere forever because pregnant people have cravings, and they have cravings often for what their body is lacking or needing. And that was in dirt. So we don't really know where the word yurumodur originates from, how midwives came to be called earth mothers. But it could be as literal as that. And it's the word used in not only Swedish, but Danish and Norwegian as well.
I noticed that when I looked the word up this afternoon. I love the Earth Mother. Jordamutter might be a tough one to bring in. I applaud you for doing it. How about just Earth Mother, Ingrid? Do you think that could work?
Yeah, that's a little too woo-woo.
I know, but okay. Jordamutter's
one of them. And in French, it's sage femme, and that means wise woman. That sets the bar a little too high. I like Jordamutter.
Yeah, it's a lovely word. Thank you for that explanation and that background. With that, how about a reading?
Sure. So the book is sort of an arc in sections, daughter, midwife, mother, and then the last two sections really are about aging as a mother, as a midwife, and as a partner. So I'll just start with a good picture of what I'm lucky enough to witness on a regular basis. The poem is called Nova Stella.
Okay.
For Lila, dedicated to the person about whom it is. Nova Stella, from the out of the blue lull that can befall hard labor, bestowing sleep, I could tell that she was fully dilated and pronounced her complete. Whereupon she roused, turned completely dilated eyes on me and said, with blinding depth and more love than I have ever seen, no one ever told me that before. And reaching down through a flash and burst of milky call, she caught a daughter.
That's beautiful. That's Nova Stella, Ingrid Anderson, reading from her latest collection of poems, Jordamutter. This poem reminds me of a reaction I had. Many of these poems are very raw, they're visceral, physically personal. We feel like we're observing and part of something intensely private. These poems come from experiences, I'm assuming. How literal are they? Are you taking these experiences and turning them into something else? Do you see what I'm asking you? They're not literally pieces of journalism, right?
Right. For truth and fact are sometimes two different things. So sometimes the poem, a poem captures a truth in ways that aren't necessarily factual in their specifics or details. And I wanted this poem to, this poem is actually quite factual. And what is not said though, but is very loud to me in the poem, is that it captures the midwifery practice or model of supporting a person who is in labor and birthing. For example, midwives don't need to do a lot of internal exams. We don't have a strict one size fits all formulaic way of approaching labor. We listen and watch and just do enough of this to be experts in knowing where progress is at without these invasive kind of impositions. And so for me to look at her and know that she was fully dilated is not magical, but it's for those of us who know the difference between medically Western medically supported labor and a more traditional midwifery supported labor, that would stand out. Another thing is the fact that she's just standing. She's not in a bed flat on her back, but she's actually standing and catching her own baby as she stands.
Yeah.
And if you're interested, I have a contrast of a poem in the describing the birth of my own mother.
Yes.
I should say the birth of myself.
Yes.
Right. And my mother's experience.
Well, you teased us with that. Are you going to read that for us?
I would love to. It's Good. Called Birthday.
Okay.
This is when I'm grown, of course, and my mother is an old woman, but the body remembers. So, birthday. A birthday should be for a mother as much as for a child, I say, and kick myself, opening her card. Housemaid, waitress, immigrant, pregnant with dreams as much as child, you were pinned like an insect on your back, leather straps around your ankles, wrists, your mind in the grips of an injected amnesiac and other women's screams. I see that she forgot my age this year, but fault lines across her blameless face and the familiar fetal fists say the body remembers. Millimeter by millimeter, fear wended down, scarping your inner sacrum, buckling your bridge of pubic symphysis, rifting your screaming ischial spines until a god you never believed in delivered you, and I was whisked to another room. Nurses bound your mammal chest, saying, breastfeeding is barbaric. I take up her bald hands like gifts in mine, unwrap the still strong fingers, unbind the crimped thumbs.
Beautiful. Birthday, two words, birthday, read by Ingrid Anderson. The body remembers. That's a beautiful line in a beautiful poem. Your bald hands. I started circling hands. That was the third incident in three poems in a row. I don't have a question, except that hands, physicality, touching is very much... should we call it a theme or just a presence in your poetry? It was for me as a reader.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to hand that to you and you see if you want to do anything with that. If not, I'll come up with something else.
Well, that's incredibly fun to hear and perceptive. I've always thought if I were a painter, my mother is a painter, an excellent draftsperson, skilled at drawing, I would do hands. I would just do hands over and over and over.
Wow.
That's fun that you call that out.
Yeah, which I understand to be the most difficult, if not, well, very difficult to do for a painter, hands. So, of course, that's what you would choose because you're a poet and you like to suffer. So family is family is prominent in these poems. We just heard about your mother. Your ancestors come up, their place in the world. Can you tell us a little bit about your family's influence on your poems, their place in your poems?
Yeah, well, the fact that everything begins and ends with mothers for me is because of my own, of course. She is... I grew up hearing her birth story, which was in South Chicago, in the brutal obstetric days of, as the poem described, women really not having any shared information or control in the process, but a lot of condescension and talking down to and being herded and coerced and told to shut up and you don't know what real pain is like. And these were all the things said to her, overheard. And then the drug that was given was scopolamine, which is an amnesiac that doesn't take pain away, but it causes you to forget your pain. So therefore, the person in labor still felt pain and had to be shackled to the bed so that they wouldn't fly off it, so that they wouldn't kick and hit. And but they were screaming. And so it was a real place of horror. And I feel like, you know, ensuing generations have inherited a kind of a trauma, you know, intergenerational trauma about that. And it explains a lot of, you know, even modern obstetrics. I still hear these stories where, you know, it looks different, but it's still very much coercion. So in any case, my mother shaped me a lot. And even though she was fierce, she was not able to stand up to that, to a lot of these systems. And so it became clear to me that I, you know, when I did my traveling and exploring in the world, I landed on midwifery. Everything sort of came together there. And I don't know how you can be a midwife without being an activist. You know, the lack of, it's just such a tough country to be a family in, to have babies and raise a family. There's no paid parental. Well, Minnesota is much better than Wisconsin. We'll state that right up front. But it's a tough time for pregnant people right now, whether, you know, regardless of what you choose to do with the pregnancy.
A scholar, an economist, and a doctor, medical doctor in Chicago, recently wrote a book called Parent Nation, which is exactly about the point you made about this country vis-a-vis other countries, especially European countries and Northern European countries especially, but many others, and the degree to which they support mothers and families before birth and long after birth. It's quite remarkable to think when you look at the data.
And I don't know if you know, but Sweden just had elections, and the conservative right-wing party, like everywhere on the planet right now, is making large gains, but never ever would they question the right to paid parental leave or the right to abortion on demand or the right to subsidized childcare or the right to high quality meals in schools or the right to safety from firearms, because it's very strict gun ownership in Sweden. And these are all pro-family measures that even the far right would never challenge.
That's amazing.
Universal health care. Those are, and I should never say never, because here we are.
Right. But it sounds like those issues transcend politics, at least for now. And here they're
at least for now.
And here they're defined by politics, unfortunately. We are well into our second half of our very brief time with you, Ingrid. Ingrid Anderson, author of Your to Murder, Poems of a Midwife. And we're a show about books and authors, and we like to talk to writers as writers, because writers listen to us. And especially with poets, it's fun to talk about how they work. So how do you work? How do you get your inspiration? Are you a writer who sits down at 6 a.m. with a black cup of coffee and knocks out a few lines? Or how disciplined are you? How do your poems get written?
Yes, that's exactly what I do. And I don't, you know, it'd be really tough to having a profession to do it any other way. But it's, you know, as I said, it's like eating, breathing for me. So it's very naturally the first thing I do when I get out of bed with my cup of coffee. And that's also when, as so many writers find, that your mind has not been burdened or cornered or boxed or led or directed by all the demands of the day and the world. So it's a great time to delve right into the poetry. And Yeah, and you know, at this point, I couldn't not do it, just like a person in labor couldn't not labor. It's really compulsive. So there's a danger in that, isn't there? I mean, it's hard to contain, and I'm self-employed. I'm in private practice, so it's a little dangerous. It really is. It can take over, and so my struggle is, you know, drawing that line and quitting for the day.
I see. Yeah. Nature is also present in your poems. When you're out taking a walk, you said something earlier which made me think that as a poet, you think about poems or maybe see poems throughout the day. Very much, I'm thinking of a photographer now who might see the world differently from myself, for example. Mm-hmm. As a poet, do you see the world differently? Are you looking at poems? Do you see poems? Do you see dead poems? I'm sorry, I'm just a joke. Do you see living poems? Okay.
I see poems in death, you know, midwifery. There are a lot of midwives who end up doing hospice work and death midwifery and who are deaf midwives. So that circle is very much familiar and kin. I literally do see poetry in everything, and I would, you know, it's endless, and I will never be bored. I can't imagine it. The book was born on the island of Gotland because both my husband and I are writers, and I turned 50, and we, you know, you hit that point where it's now or never, and our son was entering middle school. We thought, what a great time to get him out of the American schools and try something different, shake things up. So travel is really also, you know, just getting out of your culture, anything mm-hmm. that clears the vision, mm-hmm. And the hearing, you know, being surrounded by a different, immersed in a different language. These are really powerful inspirations and, you know, compost medium for poetry.
Compost medium. I love that. I'm writing that down. I will credit you. Don't worry when I use it. Ingrid, you have an event this week in Minneapolis, is that right?
I do, at 1 o'clock at American Swedish Institute, part of their Conversation and Culture series.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'll be talking about the book and
on Thursday.
The Swedish themed poems are scattered throughout the book, but there's a whole section called invandrare, which is a Swedish word meaning immigrant, and that's when we moved back to Sweden for a couple of years almost, and the word literally means in wanderer, and that's very much what that time was for me. Was the conception of the book. Yeah.
Wonderful. And I believe that's on Thursday. And we're going to hear about that in our calendar coming up between at our break here. And maybe they'll have some nice egg coffee to go with that show. What do you think?
Ah, yes.
Okay.
And folks should, if anyone out there wishes to come, tell them you're my guest.
Nice.
And come right in.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ingrid, for that. But before we run out of time, let's hear another poem.
I would love to read, segueing off what you just asked about what's poetry, what makes you want to write a poem. This is called Thin Places. That's a term I got from Robert McFarlane, the great Scottish nature writer, but he got it from Carrie Ní Dougherty, and she just wrote a book called Thin Places. And I don't know what you call those places where the world becomes permeable out of time. The picture on the cover of my book is a tiny little door on a medieval house on the island of Gotland in the middle of the Baltic Sea where we lived.
Oh, it's a real place.
And that's my portal. That's an image of a portal. And that's what this poem is about. Yeah. It's called Thin Places. The dogs and I lift our heads and sniff the air, the way infants catch their first breaths, curling back their necks and open to being mammal. The old limestone city is blanketed in snow, but our noses lead us towards something warm, steamy, slightly sweet. When our ears perk up, a call, a whistle, Our senses pull us down the street and lift our gaze to a gable window lit like a beacon or a portal in the northern night. My Lutheran grandmother warned me not to take after my mother, forever losing herself in time, not to be like the ruminating sheep grazing among the cairns. But the window is open, and a trill pours out the way joy pours out the bright yellow mouth of a blackbird. The dogs and I stand patient as statues, as aromas of Swedish pancakes drift down. Then she leans out, a flushed young woman, damp from the heat of the skillet and fanning her neck with a towel, swirls of wet curls spilling out a bright yellow scarf. Just as suddenly, she's gone. But the air remains almost edible, and her trills keep falling like stars.
Oh, that's beautiful. Beautiful images. Thin Places, read by Ingrid Anderson, our guest on Right on Radio this evening. Jorda Mooder, Poems of a Midwife. That's her new book. Before we let you go, Ingrid, tell us what's coming next. Any projects on the line? Writing projects.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for asking. I am just about ready to send out a little collection about reproductive justice poems, on that theme. And my work as a midwife in that full circle that we talked about, from release of all kinds of pregnancy to I mean, historically, how abortion has been experienced by pregnant people. Why the overworked, worn out women fill the old cemeteries because they were literally worn out to death, having a child every year or every year and a half, and being physical workers and laborers on top of those labors. So so that's taking just it's also a bridging book on those divides. And so I'm really happy to bring that into the world because it doesn't feel like it's fueling divides. It feels to me as though it's bridging them, and the title of it is what did I land on now? Well, it's not out there yet. So, but Robert Frost says Earth's the right place for love, and even though we want to escape it, sometimes love is where we come back to it. And so the collection is called The Place for Love.
Wow. So we can't wait. And please keep us in mind here at Right on Radio when that book comes out.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Ingrid Anderson about her new book of poems, Jorda Mooder, Poems of a Midwife, out from Holy Cow Press out of Duluth. Ingrid, what a treat. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, what a treat for me too. Thank you, David.
Yeah, best of luck. We'll talk to you again. Bye now.
Bye.
And now this.
You're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI. I'm Otto, and I'm joined by two friends, Shelby Richardson and Jay Eisenberg, who recently took their friendship to the next level, and that has come to fruition in the form of their performance group, We Are Married. We Are Married is opening a new show this Friday, September 16th, called Big Game, a live fever dream of a televised survivalist game show, something in the vein of Alone. Jay, Shelby, thank you for joining us. Why don't we start with you telling us a bit about We Are Married?
Hi.
Thanks
Hi.
So much for having us.
Oh, geez. Yeah, what about We Are Married? Okay, we are a performance group in Minneapolis-based. You do this part, Jay. You're better at this.
Oh, well, yeah, we're a performance group. We're Minneapolis-based for now. We have collaborators here, but also hopefully elsewhere in the future. And right now we focus on making live performance. But I would say, I mean, I know you asked us this a moment ago, Otto. You were like, theater company? And we say,
performance group.
Yeah, we say performance group.
What could it mean?
I'll definitely correct myself.
I don't know.
I mean, I guess I'd just say we both come from pretty, like, mainstream theater for the most part.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, sometimes.
And so we're not doing that now. I mean, we might still do it, but this is not that.
No, we're planning to do, we do events, we do film screenings, we're planning to make films, we're planning to make television.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so there's some filmed elements.
A streaming service? Are you starting a streaming service?
You're not wrong.
You're the first
you're
to
not
hear.
Right yet. You're not right yet. You might be wrong now, but you'll be right in the future.
I implore listeners to visit the website, wearemarried.org. It's got great design by Jay.
It's Jay's work of art, and what a work of art it is, people. Tune in. Get on there immediately, because you're in for a treat, folks. Okay? You're going to love it. It's very funny. And I want to say now, we are not legally married, okay? So don't... Jay and I both have wonderful partners who are not each other. We're not legally married.
We are legally.
Yeah, we're legally an LLC.
This is a business.
There's actually just different paperwork you have to file to be an LLC versus to get married.
Slightly different and slightly more expensive, though not by much.
Well, congratulations
on your
LLC. Speaking.
There's a registry at.
How many bread makers did you get?
Bread makers?
Yeah. Do people still get bread makers for LLCs?
Oh my God. What is this?
That's really nice. Yeah. I was thinking we could have like a honey fund maybe.
See, this is exactly what I feared going into this interview, is that we'd be saying stuff that I don't understand. This is my exact fear with life here.
Earlier, you mentioned that you came from slightly more traditional theater backgrounds and are doing less traditional stuff. You're making wavy hand motions.
Who's to say? I mean, what is tradition, Otto?
Well, sure. Good point. What is tradition?
We're not going to cast us. We're both trans. So it doesn't, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter what we're doing, clearly.
Untraditional.
I'd say did we both get BFAs? Sure. Are we both highly skilled? Absolutely. Does that make us more castable in the eyes of the powers that be?
No.
You tell us.
Not from what I've seen.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I find you very castable.
That's so...
I am not a casting director.
That's so kind of you to say.
And that's an oversight on your part.
But just in terms of your background, I guess I saw your first show, House Effer. Not the real title of the show.
Censored.
If you go right over to the website, you can see the real title.
You will know the word. You might be thinking the word right now. If you are, I'm sorry. But House Effer was a fantastic show. And something that I really appreciated about it was that, you know, I guess I would tell people that it's, you know, avant-garde, but it's still structured itself, or you structured it in a way where... you know, there were climaxes, there were acts you could feel, there were, you know, it was entertaining, as some avant-garde theater does not accomplish entertainment so well.
Oh, shots fired. First of all.
I said some, not all. I'm a big fan, but, you know.
Second of all, compliments.
Right, so avant-garde, but like... sort of accessible in its form, right? Like,
I don't want to insult you by saying it's...
No,
well,
I wouldn't be insulted
by
that.
I would say accessibility is never an insult, but...
Never. And we're both very excited by structure. We're both very passionate about structure.
Right, and thinking about things that are... I don't know, I think we talk a lot about, like, the high art, low art combination, and really wanting it to be that all at once.
Yeah, can we make a show called House Effer, but you go through what you would go through seeing... War and Peace, for instance, you know, can we do that? Can we make something where 1 minute it's completely absurd and ridiculous, and then the next it's really deep, and you're surprised by, you're shocked. It should come up to surprise you, I think.
Do you, when you're writing together, do you consciously I guess almost mathematically parse out that balance? Do you talk about the elements like, we've got one of these, so we got to have one of these?
Oh,
or...
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
My thought is no. But I think that's I think sometimes it feels I really don't like the word I'm about to use when it comes to devised work. I know. Organic. I hate it.
Okay.
But I do think there's a way of kind of finding it. Finding it as
genetically
we go.
Modified writing
genetically
only.
But
yeah. But I would say there's a sense of more like, you know, we throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see what sticks and then can go back and say, well, does it have a little too much of this? Does it need a little more of this rather than, I mean, would you say that's true?
We got to a place with House Effer, I think, where we were trying to decide, okay, this, we're kind of going back and forth between two rhythms, you know, where we're, some things are really, really fast, some things are really, really slow, and we're just sort of sandwiching those one right on top of the other. You know, that's not interesting. It's not variety. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It should be more like orchestral, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like why I answered yes is like, yes, to me, totally. That's always in my mind. We're writing something. Oh, I like how this feels to say, or I like this writing, but it's really slow. So where would that go in the piece? You know, and so then what does the content need to be to suit the form? We're both really excited about structure,
totally.
You know. But,
and it might mean that you make a bunch of pieces and then reorder them. You know, I think that there's...
Or don't use some.
Or don't, oh, we love throwing things out. We love throwing things out.
My babies.
Yeah, my babies.
Do you...
Yeah.
In having seen that show, there are seemingly improvisational elements or things that are going on with the space. It seems like there have to be improvisational elements. Since you're being conscious of the various balances that you have going on, how are you navigating those, and are you planning for them in any way?
Do you want to take this first, or shall I?
Well, it's hard, actually. I think I thought it was really tough. I was, before the show, I was always saying, this is really hard. I don't want to do this today. And then Jay was saying, no, you have to, and doing a little dance. And there, you know, I didn't handle that very well, just emotionally, to be honest. I struggled through that, but I think we always got there. It's, yeah, there's the regular improvisation of you're performing, you're in a live thing, and that's always improv to some extent. And then for us, there were these added moments where we really tried to challenge ourselves. Like, Jay, I remember you came up with something new every night for a reason. You had to leave the room at one point. And I had to hide at that point because I was supposed to be sort of off stage, but we were performing in a home. So there's no off stage. You're always in view. So I was sort of hiding in a cabinet or a closet or whatever. And I'm hearing Jay say, you know, I really want to take it to the next level with my Verizon guy. One day he was like, I got to head to driving school. I got tickets to a concert. I mean, it was every day. It was totally different. It was just ridiculous. So there are those pointed moments of truly, you wrote something new every night.
Well, yeah, I would say that we plan for the moments of improv in the show. Like, I think House Effer was a really good example of having a really clear structure, a lot of portions that were completely written. And then there were a couple of moments each night. Like for me, it was the excuse section where like I would have a seed of an idea earlier that day and be like, IKEA. And then later that night be like, I wonder what would come out of me. And I feel pretty comfortable with improvisation. But then there were parts sometimes where, I mean, you for your My First Time section about the first time you know, were intimate with a home.
I did have
where
to do a couple
there
different
was, things. I mean, that was, we also realized it was pretty audacious to subject audiences to, I would say, two 8-minute monologues in a row. Like, strap in, folks. I think, again, just
hope
being...
you like us, because we're about to talk
a lot.
Incessantly.
And that's not the whole show, right? I mean, you
no,
recall,
absolutely not.
I would say certainly, definitely having, like, those moments of planned improvisation and really not. I think we both trust each other a lot. Ooh, can I say that?
Oh, yeah.
and trust each other with also... being able to hold that space and know that, okay, in a moment of improvisation, I'm not going to suddenly be going on for 20 minutes. Like, I have a internal clock that allows me to understand, okay, it's this much time that we need to fill, and then we get right back into the structure as written.
Yeah, you can kind of tell what audiences can handle, too. I think there were times when it was like, oh, well, I'd like to say more, but I can tell the audience is bored with me doing this joke, so I'm not going to keep, you know... I'm not going to keep harping on it, but
for sure,
as much as I'd like to.
Well, you know, in the interest of the good review, I don't remember anything lasting as long as 8 minutes.
That's
it was all
wonderful. Wow,
that's it was all flying by.
That's great. 8 minutes is a long time to do anything, really.
I'm so flattered. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And actually, a performance question on the note about having to hide for a while. Jay, I observed you hiding during Shelby's monologue. Behind a couch.
You're not wrong.
And
oh yeah,
I was able to see the top half of your head the whole time, and it really seemed like you were still in character the whole time, and I enjoyed it. I was just wondering if that's the case, like, is your mindset in character, or are you like, oh my god, I have to do that entrance?
What a great question. so I'm recalling, did you see it in the condo?
I saw it in the condo.
Yeah. So in that one, in another location, I was during that section, I was like locked away in a bathroom the whole time, so not visible.
Okay.
But regardless of location, it was very intentional that a part of me was showing. And I would say I'm gonna sound like an actor right now, and I'm sorry. But I was very much in it the whole time. So that was not Jay, it was Phil, you know, on the floor, partially visible, aware that he was hiding and doing a bad job. and I think that role in particular, and I don't know if you feel this way too, Shelby, there's something about clown that's like very consuming for me. Like, I find that once I get into a clown mindset, it's really hard to get out of it. So I would say, like, in that show, I was very able to stay present with the clown the whole time, which is a really lucky thing to be able to have when you're working with a lot of audience variables that can easily take you out of it. You know, we had one performance in particular where there's always going to be someone who's maybe trying to be a part of it, like, a little too much. And you're like, who did we come here to see tonight? Mm-hmm. Like, you or us? And I don't mean to sound, like, mean. I'm just saying there are people who try and disrupt in that way. Hecklers, if you will.
And I kind of have to consciously temper that part of myself.
Oh, it's such a human thing, actually. Right?
Thank you for doing that, though.
Some don't. Well, yeah. I'm not getting paid to be there, so.
Exactly. That would be my logic.
But I do think clown makes it easy to really stay in, even in the moments where you're not, like, active in the moment. It's,
excellent. Getting back a little bit to the collaborative process for you, I historically have been very bad at editing a creative project with one singular other person. Multiple voices in a room, I think, help because there's a little bit of, like, it's not just like it's just you against me, or you're supporting me or not supporting me. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to know how your editing process goes when you're writing, when you have to make the hard choices and maybe throw someone's baby out.
Yeah, we've thrown, you're asking how those decisions go?
Yeah.
What's the process and of the
how,
decisions?
Yeah, how you find the diplomacy within it.
Diplomacy.
Oh, I don't know if it's there's diplomacy. I think it's sort of like, you know, well, like, for this process we're currently on, there was something I was really jazzed about kind of an ending for it really early on.
Yeah.
And I was just really jazzed about it. So I think I just came into rehearsal one day and was kind of like, you know, I am really attached to this. Like, I love it. I cannot stop thinking about it. I think it's amazing. I think that's going to be good. And I think we should do that kind of, like, I think we should at least try it, right? And then me just kind of saying my attachment to it, everyone else was like, yeah, you know, and then we never tried it, and we've never brought it up again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think just naming when you have emotions connected to something seems to help a lot, because that's really not, there's not been any, I'm not, like, harboring secret duress about, you know what I mean? I'm not, and the piece is the better for it, I think, because we've all said, you know, you have an attachment to things you make. You shouldn't assume that someone doesn't have an attachment to something they made, you know? So I think just that process of being honest about what you feel about
various
things.
Totally.
You know?
I think, like, naming the attachment is a really helpful part of it instead of pretending. Like, I've been a part of a lot of kind of ensemble-driven processes. And I think when people are secretly hoping, like, oh, I hope that this thing that I made ends up in the show, but they've never talked about it, then yeah, I find that the letting go is really hard because you've never even let it be. And
important
I think,
to you,
yeah, and I think, like, with that ending, we talked about it a little bit, but you and I, for all the years we've been talking, we talk about that principle of, like, what is it, the autotelic? Like, what does the piece need?
Oh, yeah,
like,
autotelic, what, yeah.
Right. So it's not just about the desires of
the
individuals.
Kirkland, yeah.
Yeah. Or even the desires of the ensemble, but, like, the piece is a living, breathing thing. What does it need in order to be what it is? And maybe it's not that ending. And
yeah, I'm trying to define autotelic. I think it's like it has its own rules. Like, it has its own internal logic. So you have to kind of let the piece have its own internal logic, which I think sounds super pretentious and unrelatable. But then when you're in it and you're going, no, like, would this help the piece? You know what I mean? Yeah, you're the creators of it. You're responsible for its existence, but you're not controlling, you know, if your kid is a truck driver or a brain surgeon either. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so if you're trying, it's probably not going to go well. It's probably going to rebel against you at some point.
Right, and horrendous. We're trying to, this is for the audience. You know what I mean? It's not for us.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think some of our favorite discoveries in the process of making these things have come, like, very out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
again, I'm thinking even about, like, Mindy.
Mindy,
like,
yeah, the
idea
other night,
of, like,
too.
A, yeah.
Just even with the headlamp. You know,
yeah,
too.
Totally.
There's some amazing stuff that just
is
comes.
This a character in Big Game?
Oh
yeah,
Mindy is from Big Game. Yeah,
okay.
And we would never have anticipated Mindy existing.
No one saw her coming.
Yeah, Mindy Pretzel-Lovick is here to stay. So,
well,
yeah.
I hope to be equally surprised.
You might be. You might be. You
and
really
others might as well,
be.
Listeners,
yeah.
if they choose to come to the show.
Which I would say they should. My first experience with your first House Effort was your first show, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Was really, really great. Gave me stuff that I continued thinking of. It wasn't just disposable entertainment either.
Wow,
compliment.
Wow, I'm loving this. I'd love to see our version of disposable entertainment, honestly.
Oh,
we've talked about making vending machines, you know, so I actually think that might be...
Like with the little toys?
Well, who knows
capsules
what's in there?
And...
We're not going to tell
sure,
you what's in
sure.
there.
Yeah, lots of baked Lays for me.
I think it's the Fritos that are shaped like cars.
Oh, delicious.
Well,
yeah.
With such a winning idea, I think this sounds like a pretty good place to wrap up. I am very glad that you're able to join us in the studio today.
Thanks so much.
Thank
for
you
having
for having us.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Oh.
Can we just say really quickly where they can find us to
yes, please.
Plug the
yes,
show?
Please.
Wonderful. So the show is running. Big Game is running next 3 weekends. It's $25. It starts at 7:30. It's not family friendly unless your family is friendly to some offensive content.
We would say 16 and up.
I think that's a great idea.
I think that's what it says.
Bring your
16-year-olds. Bring your 16-year-olds.
They're going to love it.
But we definitely, would say not family friendly next 3 weekends. You can find more information at our website, wearemarried.org. There you will be redirected to an Eventbrite page, which has a whole slew of sensory advisories and content warnings and pretty much all the information that we could give you while also still being vague enough to keep it interesting.
If $25 is too steep for us, just email us.
Yeah, and we can reduce the price for sure.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Oh, and the locations, it's in 3 different backyards across the Twin Cities metro area.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, you got to buy a ticket, folks. You can't do a walk-up because you don't know where you're going.
You don't
but
know where you're going, folks.
Audience members are emailed by 9 a.m. the day of their show with the location. But there's one in first weekend, South Minneapolis, second weekend, North Minneapolis, third weekend, Mendota Heights.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I guess we'll see you at one of those 3 locations.
Incredible.
I look forward
we'll
to it.
We'll be there.
Listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Ingrid Anderson, Jay Eisenberg, and Shelby Richardson, and all our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio at KFAI.org/Right On Radio.